Okay, so here we are again. So let us continue where we left off. And just to remind you very briefly, we have just started the gradual training, which is an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path. And we have looked at how it is that a Buddha appears in the world, or arises in the world, or comes to achieve the highest awakening. And this is, in a sense, one way to regard this is like the appearance of right view. When you see reality as it actually, that's basically the idea of right view, when you see things as they actually are. And of course, once that right view has arisen in the world, and this is one reason why the Buddha, by the way, is called the eye of the world, because he has seen things, he's the one who understands. So once that has arisen, then right view is available. Then it's a matter of expounding or kind of pointing out this right view to other people and pass it on to others so they can also realize, hopefully, the same insight that the Buddha himself has realized. So this is almost like the beginning of right view on the Noble Eightfold Path. It's like it is available, and then it's a matter of passing it on to other people afterwards. This is the arising of the Buddha, and of course, as soon as the Buddha has arisen, then the Dhamma arises. And that is precisely the passing on of that insight that the Buddha has. So this is the next thing here when we come to now, is the Dhamma being made available in the world. So what it says here is that he declares, or if you like, he makes known this world with its gods, its Maras, its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its gods and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, with the right meaning and the right phrasing. And he reveals a holy life that is utterly complete and pure. So this is when the Dhamma, first Buddha arrives, and the Dhamma arises as a consequence of that. And what he is declaring here, or what he is making known, is that all of these things, these gods, Maras, in other words, he makes known those, these are the things that kind of would have existed at that time. People would have understood the universe in these terms, right? The terms of Brahmas and Maras and these kind of things. So he makes known how this whole, you know, what is already known, how it all fits together, what it actually is, how this universe actually works. So it is really an expansion of the things that we had a look at before. When the Buddha achieves right view, he understands the idea of various types of rebirth and karma and all these kind of things. And this is really similar to that. But he phrases it in a way that is understandable for the people at that time, because this is how they would have understood it in terms of these particular names, right? And of course here, the things that we have here, like Brahma, for example, that is the the god or the goal of the Brahmanical religion, the Brahmanical religion being the precursor to modern-day Hinduism, the ancient religion of India. And Brahma was, of course, the highest goal at that time as well for that Brahmanical religion. And later on, you have things like Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, which means non-dual. Vedanta means the end of the Vedas. It's like a particular trend within the Brahmanical religion. Advanta, non-duality, this non-duality, the merger with Brahma, right? Which, from a Buddhist point of view, is very similar. It's basically samadhi from a Buddhist point of view. So these things were already there. And the idea of Brahma, I'm not sure exactly, sorry, of Mara, I'm not sure exactly what that was prior to the Buddha, but it seems the idea of Mara already existed at that time. So the Buddha lays this out, right? The various types of rebirths, the karma that brings you to all these places. And he declares this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, which is it's kind of strange. What does that mean? Because they are all before people's eyes. You don't really have to tell them about that. But my guess is that what this means is that all of the philosophies and all the religious practices that existed at that time, these were upheld by recluses and Brahmins. These were the ones who did these practices. And so he has understood all of those teachings from the perspective of his insight into reality. To what extent they conform with that insight, to what extent they deviate from that. Yeah, because that would be part and parcel of having insight, is to know what teachings work, what teachings don't work, the extent to what they work, and all of these kind of things. So he has the ability to, if you like, criticize and to, especially criticize and to understand the limits and the applicability of all of these various kinds of teachings. And the last one, its princes and its people should really be its gods and its people. In other words, all of society, etc. And of course, the last phrase here, which is the important one, which he has himself realized with insight, direct knowledge, insight, abhinya, is the Pali word there. This, of course, is a critical one, in that the Buddha has realized these things. This is direct knowledge. It's not something that he teaches from a philosophical point of view or anything like that. And then he teaches this Dhamma. Yeah, so this is how the Dhamma arrives in the world again. It is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. And the Pali word for good is kalyana, which means like beautiful or good. And the idea here seems to be that if you practice the Dhamma, it has good effects straight away. You start to feel better about yourself. You take on the five precepts and you feel, yeah, this is good. This is good stuff. And then you kind of become more kind and generous and all these kind of things. And you can feel the effect of these things straight away. If you do it with the right attitude, you do it with the right kind of, in the right way, it will actually work straight away. And this, I think, is one of those very important things on the Buddhist path, is actually to realize that the workings of kindness and generosity and all of these positive things in life, to actually feel for yourself how these work mentally, what effect they have on your mind. And the more you understand what the effect that these things have on your mind right here, right now, the more motivation you really have to practice these teachings. And that enables you to, somebody asked the other day about how can we practice sila? How can we make sure we do it all the time? Because it's hard to practice sila all the time, right? Sometimes it's really easy because you feel good. All the time you feel in this bad mood. You don't want to be kind to anybody, right? But I have to be kind, the Buddha says so. So how do we do this? And of course, this is where this sort of thing comes in. Yeah, you understand the power of these things over your mind, how it affects you. And because you understand that, you get this much more strong motivation in to do these things in the right way. So this is actually incredibly useful. And this is what I understand by karma in the present life. You do things now and you feel the consequences straight away. Okay? This is part of the karma in the present life. And this is what we can experience for ourselves. So it is good in the beginning, yeah, when you start out practicing morality, being kind, thinking kind thoughts of others. Good in the middle. And I think in the middle here is probably can be, there's probably many ways of looking at it, but can be equated with meditation practice, right? So sila, samadhi, panya, probably what we have here. So it's good in the middle, and when you start to meditate and you do it based on sila, it has great effects. And you see that for yourself, and good in the end. In other words, the panya, the wisdom that you receive at the very end is also a positive experience for you. It has the right meaning and right phrasing here. Meaning is atta in Pali here. And in Pali language, very often we have the two words, dhamma and atta. And dhamma is the doctrine. Dhamma is what the Buddha gives you. This is the dhamma right here, these four books. That the Dhamma is a teaching, and then you have the result of those teachings when you practice them, and that result is called the Atta. And so what is that result? Well, ultimately that result is Nibbana, yeah? So when it says here that it has a meaning, it means that it has a goal, it has a real effect, a real aim, a real purpose. And that purpose is not just any old purpose, it actually is the highest happiness. That is what it means. In other words, it has a real goal, a real purposeful aim towards these things. It's not just something which kind of you do a little bit and kind of you don't really get anywhere, or you get somewhere then you kind of lose it again. No, there is a real end to this and a real purpose and a real conclusion to this path. And then the phrasing, right? The right meaning, okay, or the correct meaning, or it has a meaning or it has a goal. But also the phrasing is mentioned here, which is interesting, because what that seems to mean is that the way the Buddha phrases the Dhamma is not haphazard. It's not kind of just random stuff put together. It's done with great care. Yeah, I'm just saying this already a few times, but I think it's good to repeat myself a little bit. So he has great care with these things. So when you read the suttas, you kind of look at every word and you pull it apart. Everything you know beforehand, everything is going to have some kind of meaning. It wouldn't be that if it didn't have a meaning. So because of that, you read it with great care, you take on board everything, you think about it, you reflect on it, you allow it to grow inside of yourself. After a while, it becomes a firm conviction, either that this is not true or more likely that it is true because you're here already. Yeah, and sometimes we look at these ancient texts, they are 2,500 years old, and we think, surely these texts, there's no way that they have been kept intact for 2,500 years. Right? Yeah, it's true, right? But there's no way that text can be kept exactly intact for 2,500 years. The world just doesn't work like that. The Buddha tells you straight away, Buddhism 101, anicca, impermanence, things deteriorate, things are unreliable, things change. And the same thing, of course, is true for the Buddhist texts. So we can't really expect them to be exactly the way the Buddha laid them down. And indeed, if you do comparative textual study, and the idea here is that we know that the Dhamma has been passed down in different lineages, in different schools. Yeah, in ancient India, soon after the Buddha passed away, this is human nature for you, yeah? Soon after the Buddha passed away, they started to split up into various sects and things. They couldn't agree on the Dhamma anymore. I'm right, you're wrong. No, I'm right, you're wrong. Yeah. Okay, I'll go to the north, you go to the south, and we teach different teachings. And this is how you gradually started to get a spread out of different lineages within India. Human nature, right? It happens everywhere. Even in the teaching that is all based on harmony and compassion and kindness for each other, still, of course, these things happen because human beings are just human beings. And the defilements come out and our sense of ego come out and all these kinds of things. So you get this spread. But of course, the good thing about that, which is kind of weird, is that after 2,500 years after the Buddha, because these monastics spread out in different lineages early on, it means that we cannot compare those texts that those different lineages kept intact for 2,400 years. Yeah, some of those texts were then kept in Sanskrit, some were translated into Chinese, some were translated into Tibetan, some were kept in the Pali language. Yeah, and now, you can take them, for example, the texts that are translated into Chinese, many of those, they come from the Sarvastivada tradition, some from the Dhammaguptaka tradition, some are unknown where they come from. But in the Sarvastivadins, they live in the north of India, whereas the Theravadins, they were in the south of India and in Sri Lanka. So they were far, far apart on the Indian subcontinent, really, really far apart. And the spreading out happened around the time of Ashoka, so you're talking about 2,300 years apart. Different languages. Then you compare them, if you can read both Pali and Chinese, not that many people can read both ancient Chinese and Pali. This is very rare, but there are some amazing scholars who can do this. People like Venerable Nalayo can read Pali, Sanskrit, ancient Chinese, Tibetan, plus half a dozen European languages. I think really a master of languages. And when you do that, what is kind of astonishing is the similarities that exist in the text after 2,300 years apart. You find massive similarities. You can see the sutta, you can very easy to recognize one sutta in the Pali as being the same sutta that exists in Chinese, with only small differences in it. Yeah, after 2,300 years, we're dealing with virtually the same text. Of course, there are small changes. This is exactly what you would expect. But the changes are kind of very, very often things that don't really matter very much for the interpretation of the Dhamma. Some of the standard formulas that you find in the suttas, like for example, you have the formula for the jhanas, right? The jhanas are expressed in a certain way. If you look at them now, look at them in the Chinese compared to the Pali, it's almost word for word exactly the same. First dhamma and the second dhamma are, as far as I know, exactly the same. There's maybe one word of difference in the hello. And there's one word of difference in the third jhana, I think. But again, it doesn't really make any difference for the interpretation. And that is kind of, to me, the most astonishing thing. All the big sets, right, the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, the gradual training, we look at all of that. is laid out in exactly the same way after all of these years. So this is very interesting, because it means, as far as I can see, it must mean that we still have the word of the Buddha pretty much the same it was 2,500 years ago. If we have been able to keep it intact for 2,300 years, we're talking about maybe another 150 years, and then you're back to the time of the Buddha. So if we have been so conservative for 2,300 years, then surely we were conservative for the first 150 years as well. Because it would have been an attitude, right, of the monastic order. The attitude would have been, these things need to be kept, these things need to be kept for posterity, for future generations. And in fact, the Buddha says that in the suttas themselves. So you would kind of expect that as a consequence. So because of that, this idea that they have the right phrasing, it still matters, because very likely, a lot of the time, we still have very close to the phrasing that actually was used by the Buddha himself when he taught these teachings. Yeah, so when you read this, you can kind of feel, you know, again, feel the presence of the Buddha. Right? What we have is really the teachings of the Buddha. And this is important, right? There's no point from a Buddhist point of view to be blind about these things. There's no point in kind of being blindly religious, to, yeah, I'm a Buddhist, I don't want to hear about history. But if we think like that, we're going to delude ourselves. We're going to pretend that we have something that we haven't got. And one of the great things about Buddhism is this merger, in my opinion, between spirituality on the one hand and rationality on the other. These things shouldn't be separated. If we're searching for truth, we should search for truth wherever it can be found. And we shouldn't shut our eyes to things that are inconvenient or are kind of, doesn't fit our idea of reality. So this is, and this is part of that. Anyway, so the right meaning and the right phrasing, and it reveals the holy life that is utterly, and it should really be complete there rather than perfect. Utterly complete is the appropriate translation of Pali word is Paripunna. And if you look at that in the Anguttara Nikaya, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi has changed it to utterly complete there. And I think that probably was at my urging, because I said, listen, this isn't right what you have here. So anyway, so the holy life, right, this is the Brahmacharya. Brahmacharya literally means the conduct of Brahma. Brahma being these gods that have all loving kindness and no defilements in the mind, kind of the equivalent to the jhana states, etc. So you practice in this holy life, which is supposed to be equivalent to the conduct of Brahma. That's the kind of the ideal that we're talking about here. And it is utterly complete. And of course, what that means, that it is complete, means that you don't have to look outside of the suttas, of the earliest Buddhist texts, to find any, to fill in kind of gaps or holes in the teachings. Everything is found here, right here in the suttas. You don't have to read the Abhidhamma, yeah. And actually, that's really nice that you don't have to read the Abhidhamma, because the Abhidhamma is incredibly boring. So you should be really happy about that. I don't know if you've tried to read the Abhidhamma. It's really kind of dry stuff, this old philosophy. Sometimes it's nice to have a little bit of understanding what the Abhidhamma is about, but generally speaking, it's incredibly boring and dry. There are 95 of this, and 120 of that, and it lists one thing after the other. It's nice. You know where to find your inspiration. You know what is sufficient. And in any case, even though there may be some interesting things in the Abhidhamma, of course, most people haven't got time for all of this study. It's already enough to read the suttas. It's already enough to try to practice these things to the best of our ability. That's already hard enough. And all of this other stuff kind of just gets in the way sometimes for the practice. So he teaches this, and this is the Dhamma that he teaches. And then, of course, based on the fact that he teaches this Dhamma, then somebody hears it. And then, of course, that is how we get the arising of the disciples and how we get the arising of the Sangha. Yeah, this is what happens next here. So a householder or a householder's son or a householder's daughter, right? The daughter is always missing in here. This is kind of how these texts are. They're very male-centric, but it doesn't mean that they actually aren't as male-centric as it sounds. It is just that is how things are phrased in these things. Or one born in some other clan hears that Dhamma. On hearing the Dhamma, he acquires faith in the Tathagata. possessing that faith, he considers thus. Household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to leave the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow, should be the ochre robe really, and go forward from home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, having abandoned a small or a large fortune, abandoned a small or a large circle of relatives, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. So here the Sangha comes into existence, yeah? And of course, one of the things that happens here, first of all, is that right view is transferred from the Buddha onto somebody else. And this is how the Noble Eightfold Path starts for that person. The Buddha says, yeah, wow, this is true what you're saying. And then, of course, you acquire right view of the world. And once that right view is in place, the next thing that happens is Samma Sankappa, which is often usually called right intention, which I call right aim. And that is what we see here when this person goes forward. They become a monastic. Yeah. This is kind of the idea here of right aim. You're changing your direction in life. It doesn't mean that you have to become a monastic to have Samma Sankappa. You can have that as a lay person as well. But of course, this here is the prototype of how the path is practiced all the way to the end. And that is why it includes the going forth into monasticism. It doesn't have to do that. Sometimes I know people feel a bit kind of negative about, oh, it's only for monastics. But it isn't only for monastics. It is for everyone. And so it's important to make that point, I think. Yeah. So then right aim happens. Yeah. And then when you go forth, of course, what comes afterwards here is the next step on the Noble Eightfold Path, which is all about morality, right action, right speech, right livelihood, and these kind of things. We'll have a look at that very soon. So anyway, so what is happening here? What is all this business about a householder or a householder son? Why doesn't it just say somebody goes forth? Yeah, why does it kind of use this kind of language? And I think the point here is that in those days, a householder is called the Gahapati in Pali. And Gahapati, these were kind of the basic units of ancient Indian society. The Gahapati, the householder, they would have a proper house, they would have maybe a kind of business, they would often be educated, they would live in large families together in one household, they would have servants and workers and maybe slaves, yeah? Slaves existed also in ancient India. They were not slaves in the same way as the Greeks had slaves, because the Greek slaves were often very harshly treated. They were more, it was a kind of different idea of slavery, but nonetheless, they weren't free to do whatever they wanted. So these were kind of the, if you like, the householders were like the establishment or the kind of the main units of Indian society. These were the people who had material wealth, who had education, the people who kind of were on top, if you like, of society in many ways. Yes, so the point here is that even these people, even the people who were on top of society who knew what they were doing, they didn't just go forth because they couldn't feed themselves, right? Oh, I need food. How can I get food? Okay, I'll become a monastic. This happened at that time. People who had really bad illnesses, right? And they kind of, how can I cure myself of illness? Well, the Buddha has a really good doctor. Let me go forth and become a monk. And I will go to the same doctor that the Buddha has. And so you had rules in the sutta that say, if you have certain illnesses, you can't become a monastic because the system was abused like that in the early days. So the point here is that it doesn't matter what kind of background you have, what kind of social status you have, what your education is, all of that is irrelevant. Because the Dhamma is broader than that. It encompasses life for everybody. Regardless of your station in life, you are, this is for you. It is not about some small little suffering that you had in life. It is about life overall being, there are problems in life overall for everyone, starting with old age, sickness and death. Yeah, you can't really escape these things. It doesn't matter where you are. So this is the point here. The point is to kind of make it clear that this teaching is for everybody. It's not just for those people who can't feed themselves. So it wouldn't be much point in having a teaching if that was the whole reason anyway. So, and then it says, a householder or householder's son And then, of course, one born in some other clan, this will then name anyone else. Yeah, so anyone else from any kind of level in society. And this is, of course, one of those nice things about the Buddhist teaching, is that it is a completely non-discriminatory. There's no discrimination there according to where you, what kind of part of the society you come from. It's not like the Brahmanical teaching was just for the Brahmin. If you're a non-Brahmin, there's no chance of becoming part of that priesthood. Buddhism is open to everyone. And this is a very important part of this. And of course, when you read the sutta, you read that people from all parts of society, all walks of life, actually attained to the higher stages of the path, to arahantship and to all of these kind of things, regardless of background. Because spiritual ability and social status are obviously not the same thing. They're very different. It is a bit unfortunate that these days there are certain places where you find that even in Buddhism there is this kind of distinction. If you're only allowed to ordain if you come from a certain background or a certain caste and these kind of things. And sometimes that's kind of creeping into Buddhism in places, which is very unfortunate, because the whole point of it, what is nice about it, is that it is open for everyone and everyone works together. And it should also be open for women as well, right? So we should have bikinis. And it's really nice to have Aya Vimala here and Aya Catherine sitting next to her. It's really great because it shows us that we can go back and have some of these some of that same equity that we had at the time of the Buddha, also within the Buddhist teachings. So it's great, actually. Do you want to see how far away it is from here? Yeah.
6 hours
ride. 6 hours ride, okay. Well, that's not too far. By Australian standards, that's very far. That's my story. So, but it's really nice. And who knows what the future will hold for, you know, Buddhism around the world. I think that the Sangha of women has a very good chance of becoming very strong. If you look at some of the Asian countries, that's exactly what has happened. And it's great that we need that kind of support from the female side of the population, because there just isn't enough monks. So we need more monks as well. And we can have more teachers, and we can kind of become stronger together in that way, if we work together instead of excluding each other. Anyway, so everybody, so they go forth, they hear the Dhamma, and when they hear the Dhamma, they acquire faith in the Tathagata. Yeah, so again, you see the Buddha, you see that the way he teaches and the way he practices, his personal qualities, they match each other. There isn't any discrepancies or problems there. So faith arises, confidence arises. And when that confidence arises, you consider the following thing. Household life is crowded and dusty. It sounds really strange in English, right? The house of that is crowded and dusty. Yeah, okay. Maybe they forgot to vacuum the house or something. But the idea here, of course, is that crowded, I think it's very obvious what crowded means, yeah? Especially in those days, you would have large families and you would have lots of children and you would have grandparents, many generations living together, and you have workers and servants and all these kind of things. So it probably was quite crowded. And the idea of dusty here, the Pali word for dusty is raja, and raja means dust. And it is a metaphor in the suttas for defilements and sensuality in particular. Yeah, so when you live close together, when you are in a family like that, it is very easy to stir up the defilements. Yeah, this is one of the things that I found when I kind of moved out from living with my family. Actually, I hadn't lived with my family for a few years at that time, but anyway. The difference between living by yourself, especially in the kuti, in the forest somewhere, and living close to other people, especially people who are close to you, is that when you live by yourself in the forest, it is almost like you have this perspective on things. You have this ability, if you kind of get too close, you have the ability to cool down a little bit, right? You go back to your kuti, you don't get too hot, because you always have this refuge you can kind of withdraw back to. And this, that distance, that physical distance, I have found means that you have more evenness in your mental evenness in your life, because you always have more physical distance and also more mental distance at the same time, because you don't have the same kind of attachment, the same psychological closeness to your fellow monks as you would have had to family members. There's a very different feeling between those things. So in family life, because we are so close together, we rub up against each other, and it's very easy for defilements to arise, right? Whether they are attachments or whether they are upset and negativity and anger. That is just the nature of living closely together. It's something you can't really avoid. And this is exactly what the monastic life kind of counteracts, because you have that space around you, psychological and physical space. And this is why it says here that life gone forth is wide open. Again, this is the metaphor for this space that you have around you, both psychological and physical. And I think that is one of the really nice things, actually, about monastic life. There are so many nice things about monastic life, especially if you want to be a monastic, yeah? If you don't want to be a monastic, then it's different, of course. But there's so many positive things about it, and this is one of those many, many positive things. So he considered that. So maybe I should go forth, right? It is not easy while living in a home to leave the brahmacharya utterly complete and pure as a polished shell. So you want to be really, you want to polish that mind so it becomes really shiny and bright. And that is more difficult, he's saying here, living at home, than it is if you go forth. And of course, that is why the Buddha established the monastic life. It is not because he wants to kind of put down people who are not monastics or anything like that. He establishes it because it is supposed to be the highway, if you like, to Nibbana. It's the highway towards ending all suffering and ending all problems. Yeah, and he says as much in a certain sutta where he says that the different talks about the different fields where if you sow your seed in a field which is very rich and very fertile, the crops will be very abundant. If you sow your seed in a field that is kind of a bit rough, you know, a bit rocks and kind of not so fertile, you get less crop. And if you sow your seed in a field that is absolutely rocky and there's just a little bit of earth in there, if you're lucky, you get a few crops coming up. And the Buddha said it's similar. When he teaches, most of his teachings are given to the monastics. Second, his teachings are given to the lay Buddhist community. And last category that he teaches are what he called outsiders, outside religious people of different traditions. So these are kind of different fields and the ability to bear fruit. So the idea here is, of course, that the monastic field is, that's why he created this monastic life, to kind of enable the maximum potential of the teachings to come forth. But of course, in reality, it's more complex than that. Because in reality, there are monastics who practice well, there are monastics who don't practice at all, but just chill out all day and watch TV and that kind of stuff, you know. You find that. And of course, that's just, again, it's human nature. And the vast majority of monastics, they will be doing all kinds of things, like social service is a very common thing for monastics to do, which is nice, but it kind of misses out a little bit on the Noble Eightfold Path. And very often, monastics are specialists in rituals and that kind of stuff. They sit in the city temple and they do all kind of rituals for lay people. A bit like the Brahmins did in the old days, a bit the kind of stuff the Buddha criticized the Brahmins for doing, right? That's what monastics are doing now sometimes. So this is how things tend to go. This is just how human nature works or doesn't work, whatever you want to say. But then you have the monastics who practice well, and the same thing with the lay people, right? You have some lay people who are incredibly well practiced, far better than the vast majority of monastics. You think, wow, that's actually very inspiring sometimes as a monastic as well, to see lay people who practice so well and get really, really good results on the Buddhist path. And then, you have all those lay people who just are Buddhist in name only. Who don't keep the five precepts. I'm a Buddhist. So, and what do you do? Well, I kind of worship the Buddha twice a day, and that's what makes me a Buddhist. And so, the gap is enormous in both directions. So it's very important not to kind of to be too categorize things too clearly into categories, because things are always very overlapping and very diverse, of course. But anyway, the idea with the monastic life, that's the idea, is to be the highway to Nibbana, if you like, the fastest route to awakening. So, and that's what he does, and then he thinks, suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and go forward from the home life into homelessness. And on a later occasion, abandoning a small or a large fortune. So you abandon a small or a large fortune And the idea here, this is kind of the idea that when you become a monastic, you kind of become poor. You don't have anything yet. This is kind of the idea. Again, the difference between ideal and reality is that, again, sometimes there is a large gap between the ideal and the reality, unfortunately. That is, anyway, how it's supposed to be here. So sometimes that's a bit scary. I've met some of you, and you have told me that you kind of, some of you I know are interested in becoming monastics, and maybe that will happen one day, but this is kind of scary to give up everything that you own and then become a monastic. What if you fail, right? What if monastic life doesn't work out for you? What are you going to do? You come back and you become sleeping on the streets or something like that. That would be very nice. So you, the way that this actually works in practice very often, the way we do things at Bodhinyana Monastery, for instance, is that, well, you take all your wealth, whatever that might be, you put it to one side, like you have a bank account or whatever. You don't use it, but it kind of sits there and waits for you in case you want to disrobe later on. Yeah? And especially the first 5 years of monastic life, that's usually when people are the most shaky. So kind of, you know, a lot of uncertainty because you don't understand the Buddhist teachings properly and all these kind of things. Then after 5 years, that's when you kind of make a decision about what to do with your worldly things. And very often what you do is that you give it to your parents or you give it to somebody you trust. So that even then, if down the line you do decide to disrobe, you still, it's not as if you're going to start out from scratch and have nothing at all to live on when you if you do disrobe. So there are ways around this, yeah? That's the wrong way of putting it, because it sounds like you're trying to avoid this. But there are ways of dealing with it that are sensible, and it doesn't put you in a completely, you know, terrible situation if things don't work out the way you think they should work out. So this is just about being practical. And so that is the idea of abandoning a small and a large fortune, and if you do that in the right way, then you don't really have very much. And it's actually very nice not to own own very much in this world. It's really, really nice. I don't really own very much at all. If you know, the little kuti, the little hut I live in the forest is not owned by me. It's owned by the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And I just borrow it, right? Or kind of they say, okay, you can live here. And so I live there until I don't live there any longer. But I never really, it's not mine. And all I have are the few possessions in my kuti. I have to confess, I have quite a few books in my kuti. That is the only kind of the negative side after where you accumulate all these books. But apart from that, I don't have very much. And it's actually very nice, it's very light, it's very kind of burden, few burdens in a sense. And no bank account, none of that kind of stuff, which is quite quite handy. Like actually, one of the great things about monastic life is not having any money. Yeah. People think that it's great to have money, but money is such a headache. When you have no money, you can finally breathe, you can kind of relax. And it is amazing how, surprising how supportive people are of monastics. If you live your monastic life well, you can get by anywhere in the world. People will pick you up, people will support you, people will do all kind of anything that you need to survive without any problem at all. And it's very beautiful, this kind of mutual relationship between the monastic community and the lay people. The lay people support you, and in turn you give some spiritual teachings. Yeah, and it's actually very, very beautiful, very, and it brings, I think, if it's done in the right way, it brings happiness all around for everyone. And it's a very kind of, a very beneficial way of kind of living together. It's amazing, come to our monastery in Perth, the kind of support we get there is absolutely astonishing. An ordinary weekday, people drive all the way from Perth. It's over an hour's drive down to our monastery because we're out in the bush in the forest. And on an ordinary weekday, we get 30, 40 people coming to the monastery. Everybody bringing food, right? Cooking it up. On a Sunday, you might get 200 people coming to our monastery. You get another 200 people coming to our city center. Another 100 people going to the nun monastery. On an ordinary Sunday, on a big day, like the big occasion when you have like a Katina ceremony or Vesak, you might have 2,000 people coming here. So the support is very, very, very large. And so there's a very kind of strong Buddhist community. And it's very, I think it's very wholesome and very positive. And I think it brings happiness to everyone. Anyway, so you abandon a small and a large fortune. You abandon a small and a large circle of relatives. Yeah, so you abandoning sounds a bit harsh, but what it means is that you give up the close relationship you have with them. It doesn't mean that you abandon them completely. I'm actually going back to Norway to visit my parents and my family after this trip to Germany. So I'm kind of doing my duty to my parents as well while I'm here in Europe, which is very handy. So you don't abandon them completely. In fact, our duties to our parents is actually one of the very important things according to the Buddhist teachings. And one of the things that I would recommend you to think about if you are serious about the Buddhist practice is the relationship that we have with our parents. On the one hand, you can make very bad karma if you treat your parents in the wrong way. On the other hand, you can make really good karma if you treat your parents positively. There's a very strong field of karma once parents. It's important not to make it into a burden, because if it becomes a burden, then it loses the joy. But you do it in a positive way, and you try to give back to your parents what they have given to you over many, many years. And it's very nice when you do that in the right way, and you feel good about it, and you can actually make much quicker progress on the path, because the amount of good karma you can make in this way actually is a lot, and very powerful. So abandoning here is a relative term. That's why it's relative, perhaps. So, abandoning a small or large circle of relatives. He shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the ochre robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. So now you have the bhikkhu and the bhikkhunis who have gone forth into homelessness. And the sangha has started. Yeah, Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And here we see the right intention. And now, once this has happened, and I will continue a little bit longer, because otherwise we'll never get through this sutta. What happens now, of course, is the virtue aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. So now we're going to talk about morality. This is one of those areas in Buddhism that is very interesting. Because Buddhist morality is quite different from the ordinary kind of morality that you find in most religions. And it is, to me, it's one of those actually very special things about the Buddhist teaching, how the morality is worked out. And it's worked out on very natural principles. The vast majority of religious morality is based on rules. It's a rule-based morality. Thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that. And you have the Ten Commandments, that kind of stuff. This is the standard kind of religious morality. But Buddhist morality, yes, you have lists like the five precepts and these sort of things, but the basic, the foundational morality of Buddhism is a natural morality that arises out of a certain worldview, a certain way of doing things. That basically, what that morality is about is that anything where you hurt others or you hurt yourself, that is bad. Where you support others, you kind of do something which is beneficial for others and beneficial for yourself, that is good. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. It's if you hurt somebody else, you are doing something to them that they don't wish. So you are making bad karma, you're doing something bad, it's immoral. And if you sense in regards for yourself, and if you do something positive, do something that other people like it, then you're doing something which is moral. Again, it makes sense because you're helping them. You're giving them happiness. You're supporting them in the right way. This is what I mean. It's based on natural principles of how we look at the world, how we feel about things. So what does this actually mean? How do we know that we are helping other people? How do we know that we are supporting them and that we're not hurting them? Sometimes this is very difficult to know. Yeah, we don't really have full overview of how other people work. So what it comes back to in Buddhism is our intention in how we deal with other people. Yeah, because we cannot always be 100% sure whether we're actually helping others or not. Sometimes you say things, you think you're being kind, you take it the wrong way or something like that. So the intention is what really matters. So in Buddhism, we have the idea of karma. The word karma means action. And that karma is given its ethical content, if you like, whether it's moral or not. That content comes from our intention. What is our intention? And only if you have intention in what you're doing, is it then either ethical or unethical. And that intention, in turn, has a certain color to it, right? Intention is what we want to do. And that color in the intention is where we are coming from, our motivation. What motivates us? What drives us in doing a particular act? So the motivation in Buddhism can either be good motivation or it can be a bad motivation. It can be bad in the sense that it can come from ill will or selfishness or confusion. Or it can be the opposite. It can from a sense of metta, a sense of compassion, or a sense of clarity about what you're doing. Yeah, so this is the motivation. Once you have a motivation, you have ill will, then the intention arises to do something to somebody else. And then you act on that. And that act then becomes the karma that you are doing. And it is driven by the intention, which in turn is colored by the motivation, which drives it. And that's so in Buddhism, the motivation is the all-important thing that decides whether you are acting in the right or the wrong way. And this is found in the suttas. If you go to the Anguttara Nikaya, you find suttas about this particular thing. Motivation is called the mula in Pali. Mula means root. Yeah, so it's like the root of what drives intention, what drives action from a Buddhist point of view. And this is what decides whether an action is ethical or unethical. All you have to know is the motivation. You have to know the state of your mind. Why are you doing something? And if you are clear about the state of your mind, then you know whether you're doing bad or good karma. So what does this mean? Why? How come we have the five precepts? And what the five precepts got to do with this? Yeah, you may wonder that if it is so clear, all you have to do is to know the state of your mind. As long as you're coming from kindness, you're going to make good karma. If you're coming from evilness, badness, right? Then you're going to make bad karma. If you're coming from selfishness, you're going to make bad karma. So why do we need these five precepts? Why not just say, be kind? And indeed, you could say that. You could say, just be kind. That would be good enough. But yeah, that is an actual a rule which is even more useful in a sense than the five precepts. Just be kind. That is really sufficient. But the problem is that sometimes in life we get confused. Yeah. Sometimes the amount of information, the amount of things happening, going on in your life is just so much. Well, sometimes you don't know up from down or black from white anymore. And you can, what am I supposed to do now? Or you get so full of some kind of defilement, some kind of desire or ill will, which tells you, act now, quickly. Kill this person before they kill you or whatever, yeah? Something like that. And because of that, sometimes we need the precepts just to keep us in check and remind us of the most major areas of ethical concern in life. Yeah, so although kindness is really enough, sometimes kindness is not clear enough to make it clear to us how we should be acting in particular situations. And that is why it is very useful to have precepts. Precepts that tell you, stop, be careful, you're now kind of treading into dangerous territory. Yeah, but they are not the end-all and the be-all of Buddhist ethics. They are just approximations to what is ethical conduct and not. So this is a very important thing. So it means that sometimes, and I will show you this later on, how this actually works. It means that sometimes you can go against the precepts, but actually act ethically. Yeah? Because the precepts are just approximation. And the real ethics is about motivation and what drives us. It means sometimes it's possible to break the precepts and still act ethically. And this is an important thing to remember, because what it does is expand our scope especially, you know, in the modern society, we have very different ethical concerns than people had 2,500 years ago. Now we have all kinds of, moral dilemmas like euthanasia and all of these kinds of things. And the question is, what is the Buddhist attitude towards these things? Is euthanasia, is that acceptable? Assisted suicide, is that okay? Stem cell research, all these kinds of things. How do we deal with these things? And the Buddhist ethics are so flexible that it's quite easy to understand how to deal with these things as well, once you understand and you apply the Buddhist ethical framework in the right way. Very flexible framework, very beautiful, and it gives rise to some very beautiful results when you apply it in the right way. And I will show later on how we do that. So that is the first thing about Buddhist ethics, to understand that it is all driven by motivation. What is our motivation when we practice, when we act, rather? The second thing about Buddhist ethics, which is important to understand, is that it's not really black and white ethics. It's not this is wrong, this is right. Yeah, very often you have, as a monastic, you often have people coming to you and you say, oh, you know, I did this. Is it good or bad? And I say, I don't know. Is it good or bad? I have no idea. You did something. Only you can know that because you had to look into your mind. What drove that action? What was your motivation? Why did you do it? That is what makes it good or bad. The act itself is basically neutral. Yeah, the act itself. I mean, some acts are very likely to be bad, but not necessarily. And this is kind of the point here. The act itself is that you cannot tell from the act whether it's good or bad. And what is interesting in how the Buddha talks about this, he says that there are acts that are bright, with bright results. Yeah, so in other words, good acts with good results. There are acts that are dark with dark results. In other words, really bad acts. And then there are acts that are both dark and bright with both dark and bright results. And this is like the acts that we do as human beings. Human beings, we are experiencing the results of acts that were both dark and bright. And now we're experiencing dark and bright results. Our life is a mixture of a little bit of happiness, a little bit of suffering, yeah, and sometimes it's kind of somewhere in between. It's neither really happy nor something, kind of neutral almost. And this is the result of those acts that are both dark and bright. And this is because when you look at your motivations, often those motivations are neither very pure nor are they very bad, evil. They're kind of somewhere in between. Or they might be mixed, right? There might be a little bit of greed in there, but also some generosity. You think, you know, you're going to give a nice gift, right? You give an act do an act of generosity to the Sangha, and you think, yeah, I would like to have a really nice Mercedes in return for that. Yeah? Or something like that. I'm just making up some silly scenario. The point is that sometimes we think a little bit like that. We want something in return for our generosity. Or when you are kind to somebody, sometimes we expect people to be kind back to us. Yeah, but it's very rare that we kind of are kind to somebody else and don't care at all how they act back to us. If they are nasty back, okay, that's, you know, no worries. You know, that's the part of the course or whatever. It tends to be a little bit of a transactional business relationship. I'm kind to you, you are kind to me. If you are bad to me, I'm not going to be kind to you, right? This is how things often are. And because of that, our motivations are a little bit mixed, and they're not entirely pure. So very often, what we are talking about is karma, not so much black and white, right or wrong, but very often like grey. Yeah, karma is kind of grey. So you do a grey act because your motivation is so mixed. This is how I understand the Buddha's idea of black and white, like grey. So you do a grey motivation, you get grey results. Yeah, that's when you sit here, meditate, and oh, you find this really boring and tired or whatever. Yeah, I've had enough of this. It's kind of very grey result. It's not really, nothing is really kind of, it's not happy nor very miserable. It's kind of neutral in the middle there somewhere here. And sometimes life is like that. It's kind of greyish. And that comes from all those grey motivations that you had in the past life somewhere here. So very often what we have to do is not to make actions or do actions that are entirely bright with entirely bright results, because that is actually very difficult. It's very hard to do something which is entirely bright, because it means that you have no defilements in your mind. Your mind is entirely pure, which of course happens very rarely for most of us. It really only happens after you get into deep samadhi or a jhana state or something like that. So our job is more to move towards the lighter sides of grey. Yeah, so you ask yourself, how can I do an act which is less dark, more lighter kind of grey act? Yeah, so you imbue your actions with a bit more friendliness, a bit more kindness, a bit less greed, a bit less selfishness, a bit less ill will, and all these kind of things. And as you do that, you're moving up the scale and getting to the brighter shades of grey in terms of your actions. Yeah, so this is really what we can expect as human beings. So you move on to those. So you're not too ambitious about things. If you're too ambitious, you're going to fail miserably and completely. Instead, we do things that actually are within our range. And the brighter shades of grey is actually within our range. So this is, again, I think, a very suitable and good way of thinking about karma, because it fits with our experience and it fits with what life actually actually is like. So that is a little bit of background about Kamma for Jünger. And what I'm going to talk about next is actually how this is applied in reality. We're going to have a look at right action and then right speech afterwards. But I think maybe it's a little bit too late to get onto that now. So I think I'll probably stop there. And then tomorrow morning we can actually apply these ideas to specific cases. But somebody asked me to summarize a little bit. I forgot to do that after the last one. So I'll summarize very briefly the point of what I've been saying so far, right? So the point behind all of this, in summary, is that, first of all, you have right view. And as a consequence of right view, of seeing the world, of seeing that there is a problem, part of that right view is to see that there is a problem that needs a solution. So once you see there is a problem that needs a solution, you get the right purpose and you get the right aim on the Buddhist path. And either you go forward as a monastic or you start to practice the teaching as a lay person. And then the first part of the right aim, right purpose, is to practice morally, to live a moral life. This is the first aspect of that. How do we live the moral life? And it's all about our motivation. What is it that drives us in life? What is the kind of the thing which is the final driving force behind our actions? If that those driving forces are positive, if they are wholesome, it's good karma. If they are bad, selfishness, greed, that kind of stuff, it's bad karma. And that's how we decide ultimately on what is moral and what is immoral on the Buddhist path. That is a very brief summary for you, but it is, I think, roughly what I was talking about. Okay, so that is all for now. So we'll see you again later on this evening. But yeah, I was thinking, would you like to do the guided meditation tonight? Yeah, that would be great if you would mind. Yeah, okay. So there will be a guided meditation, and after I will come out for the Q&A after that. Okay.